Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Ayin Tedem with Bet, just reviewing the Mishnah again. A motzi hotzaot on nechsei ishto, someone who invests, puts money into his wife's property. Hotzi arbe v'achal kima. If he expended a large amount of money, but he got some benefit from it, he ate something from the nechsei malog, or kima, he invested very little, v'achal charbe, and he got a large harvest that year, he ate a tremendous amount from his wife's property. Masha hotzi hotzi, whatever he invested, whatever he put in, is done. Masha achal, achal. And whatever he ate or benefited is his to keep. There's no reversal, there's no returns over here, because they are getting divorced. And in the divorce, as long as he acted properly, which is that he invested in the property, whether he invested a lot or little, and number two is that he was a beneficiary of that investment because he got some payrot out of it, then we say that those offset each other, and he has no cheshbon with the wife. Hotzi v'lo achal. On the other hand, if he expended money and he invested in the property, but he got no benefit whatsoever, yishba kama hotzi v'ito. Then he takes a shvuah as to how much he expended, and then he'll get reimbursed for that money that he expended, that he invested in the property, because over here, he invested without getting any value, any of the payroll back in return. You can see over here in the Tosafot and Peyam and Aleph, it's a Mishnah in Shavuot that lists all those people that take a Shavuah and take their money. In general, a Shavuah is a way to be puter. It's a way to exempt one from payment. It's in lieu of payment. Over here, you have the right to take a Shavuah and then collect the money. So the Mishnah in Shavuot has a list of all those types of Shavuot where you take a Shavuah and you collect. This does not appear there. So he says that the only time that we do this is when there's a counterparty. The Mishnah in Shavuot was talking about when someone is coming to take a Shavuah to take it when there's some sort of machloket, there's some sort of controversy about the payment. And then he takes a Shavuah and he collects. Over here, there's no counterparty in a sense. It's for the protection of the woman, but she doesn't deny that he invested in the property. She's not saying he didn't invest in the property. The reason it's not enumerated in the list in Shavuot is because it doesn't have that character trait to it. But over here, there's nobody denying that he actually invested in the property. It's just a question of assessing how much he invested in the property. All right, so Tosafot gives another answer, possibly that Mishnah is telling us things that you do collect with the Shavuah. I would have thought over there, those are cases where even with the Shavuah, you wouldn't be able to collect. Over here, there's no reason not to allow him to collect the money when he takes a Shavuah. Again, because he invested the money, there's nobody denying that he invested the money. We're just trying to get an assessment of his investment. Now, the Gemara asks, v'kama kima, how little does he have to benefit from the next day malog and his investment in order for that to wipe out any claim against the woman? Rabbi Asi, afilu grugoret echat. Even one fig is sufficient. V'hu she'achla derech kavod. That's as long as he eats it in a nice manner, in a way that's not rushed, meaning that he enjoyed. It wasn't like he grabbed it and stuck it down his throat. So Amar Rabbi Abba, Amar Beirav, afilu shigra de tamre. Even a shigra of tamarim. Rashi over here brings two interpretations. One interpretation is that it is a bunch of dates, like a cluster of dates on the palm tree. The other one is that it is pressed dates, and it's one date taken off of a bundle of pressed dates. Rashi's issue with this Gemara is that in general we find that dates are more expensive and more valuable than figs. So then what is meant by here, afilu, even? If he ate a fig and he ate a date, as Rashi points out, that if someone owed someone figs and they paid them back with dates, tavola bracha, that he paid it back with dates. Dates are considered to be a much better product and a much more valuable product. So how can you say afilu? If he ate a grugoret, then what does it mean afilu tamre? So Tosafot, Rabbeinu Tam, answers that depends on what type of tamarim. Normally, you're right. Dates are better, are considered to be more of a delicacy than a fig. But in this instance, where they are pressed together, then they're not as good as the figs, or they don't have that status. It's really the fresh dates or the good dates. These are shigra de tamre, seem to be some sort of inferior date. And therefore, it's afilu. Even that date, even that small date, is enough that if he benefits, he may not make a claim for the remainder of his investment or his layout expenses for the field. By Rav Bibi, Chumtza de Tamre, Rashi says over here, is Lachash Sumehen Shechar. They make them into beer. They made date beer. And this is the dregs, or the residual, after they make the date beer, after they press them and squeeze them. And this is what you have left over. If you have a bunch of those together from the psolet, or they were already smushed together in order to make them into sheikhar, in order to make them into beer, if you have something like that, which is so inferior, is that sufficient? Teku, that we don't know. That we don't know if that's sufficient to be considered kim'ah. Lo achla derech kavod, mai. What happens if he doesn't eat it derech kavod? He doesn't eat it at a meal. He doesn't eat it in such a way that you would consider to be significant because of the manner or in the context in which he ate it. That grants it a certain amount of significance. If you don't have that, what's the din? How much do you have to eat in order to be classified as kima? Amarula, pligi ba tre amurai ba'amarava. Two amaraim argue about this in Eretz Yisrael. Chanamar biki isar. Chanamar biki dinar. One of them says it's the size of an isar. One of them says it has to be the size of a dinar. Now Rashi says it's the value. You would have to eat a value worth of dates or figs or whatever it is that you're eating that adds up to an isar. And the other one says it has to add up to a dinar. So that gives it significance because of its value. So you can create significance because of value, which is isar or dinar. Or you can create significance because it's eaten in the context of a meal or a significant meal, and that gives it value. You could argue here that their statement of isar and dinar is not about value, but about size. Sometimes we see that the Gemara uses coins for sizing, such things as trefot and other things like that. So here too, you could argue that isar kedinar is telling you about a size. If you don't eat a derech kavod, this is the size that you need to eat in order to have that wipe out your claim for expenses. Amrei Dayane de Pumpadita. So the Dayanim in Pumpadita say, who is Rav Papa Bar Shmuel, Avad Rav Yehuda Uvda. Rav Yehuda actually had a case like this. Bechavilei Zmurot, where the case where he took little pieces of wood, he took branches, small branches or kindling, and that was sufficient. Generally, it means taking it off of the prunings of the vineyard. He took some of the prunings of the vineyard to use for firewood. And based on that, he said he was not entitled to any reimbursement for his expenditures. Rav Yehuda the Tamei, now Gemara says, that's Rav Yehuda the Shitato. Dam Rav Yehuda, achla orla shvi'it vikilaim, harizeh chazaka. If a person eats during the years of orla, during the year of shvi'it, or during the year of kilaim, it has a din of chazaka. Over here, we're trying to establish that this individual owns the land. So he comes with a claim, and they ask him for a shtar. He said, I lost the shtar. So the Gemara in Bava Batra tells us, if you lose the shtar, your other option is to show that you worked, ate, or utilize the land for 3 years. So if you did so for 3 years, that is, in lieu of a shtar, shows that you have ownership. You establish a chazakah on the land. Over there, it seems that years where you wouldn't otherwise work the field or benefit greatly from the field, that we wouldn't consider those as shnei chazakah, because there's no reason for the owner to object to the individual being in the land during that period of time, because there's nothing really there. Those are orla. In the early years of the tree's development, where you can't eat the fruits, the only thing you can do is get benefit from the branches or the twigs when you prune the items. The fruit themselves are asur b'achila, asur b'hana'ah. So the only value you get out of there is the kindling or the twigs that you would take. Shvi'it, the whole field is hefker. So whatever you take, yeah, you can benefit, you can eat the perot shvi'it, but it doesn't improve anything about your ownership, because anybody could do that. And kilayim Rashi over here describes as a case in which they planted kila'ayim, but in a case where the vines did not become asurim. Bazmurot lo nesru. For whatever reason, the wood or the branches there did not become asur, and therefore he was able to benefit from them. Tosafot explains, according to Rashi, how is it possible that you have kila'ayim there, where the fruits are asurim and not the branches? So he says it's a case where the fruits grew more than 1/200th. So therefore they became asurim, but the branches themselves didn't grow that much. So it's a point in time where the kilayim has yet to affect the branches or the plant itself versus the fruits who have already been affected by the kilayim because they've expanded or grown more. They are faster to ripen or to grow, and therefore they would add on 1/200th to become a serim before the vine or the branches themselves. In all those cases, Rabbi Yehuda says, Arizeh Chazakah. That's enough to establish your rights to the field, or that you own the field, because you now have another year under your belt in which you worked or took from the field. So you see from this that Rabbi Yehuda considers this murot, the kindling or the little wood that you take off the field, to be significant enough to deem it a chazakah. And similarly over here, he thinks that as being significant enough to disallow your ability to collect or to be reimbursed for your expenditures. Tosafot over here says that the girsa and chazkata batim is actually just the opposite. It says over there, from Rabbi Yehuda, achalashvit v'kilayim eno chazakah. That if you eat in those years, it's not classified as a chazakah. How do you reconcile between the Gemara in Bava Basra, which seemingly says that Rabbi Yehuda says no chazakah from here, versus our Gemara over here, which seems to indicate there is a chazakah? The perisham rashba kagon shachal perut di surah. It depends what. Over here, Rabbi Yehuda is talking about not eating the perot that are asurim, but rather eating the items that are mutarim from the field, or utilizing the items that are mutarim. The branches or the kindling or the little pieces of firewood that you took out of the field, which are mutarim, that establishes a chazakah. In Baba Batra, he's talking about utilizing the orla, the fruits of orla, the fruits of kilayim, things that are completely asurim. That is why it's not chazakah. Shloach al kederach ochlim, because that's not a normal way to partake or benefit from the field. Miu, midelo ma'akshiluhu adodi. Then Tosfot says, it's a really nice answer, great way to reconcile it. Says, but the Gemara itself should have asked on that. That's such a blatant stira that you should ask Rabbi Yehuda in this case and reconcile it. Nira the hatam nami gasina narizu chazakah. He says they should change the girsa and the Gemara in Baba Batra, that it should read arizu chazakah. V'chein garis Rabbeinu Chananel. And sure enough, that is the girsa and Rabbeinu Chananel over there, consistent with our Gemara. V'chein nimsa b'sefer shel Rabbeinu Gershom. So he brings other girsaot that seem to corroborate the girsa that we have here, which is, it is a chazakah. So I'm Rabbi Yaakov, I'm Rabbi Chista, amotzi otzaot anichzei ishto k'tana, person who makes expenditures on his wife who is a k'tana. So here, if she's a k'tana and he's married to her, we're talking about here a marriage midrabanan, talking about a yitoma b'chaye av, who's married off by her mother or her brother. So now you have only kedushei derabanan. What's the risk here? She's going to perform miyun. She's going to reject the marriage. She's going to annul the marriage. And then this guy's going to be left high and dry. He's going to expend all this money. She's going to say, I no longer want to be in the marriage. And now he just lost all the money that he invested. So there's a disincentive for him to invest in the property because it's so risky that she can walk at any moment. So therefore, they established, they made a takana, that it would be kimotzi on nechsei acher dami. That if he expends money on this property, on the young girl's property, it'll be the equivalent of him investing money in a third party or in someone else's property. Now that's in a case where it's his wife. And if he gets divorced from her, he's the one who's initiating the divorce over there. So in that case, he knows that when he divorces her, he's going to lose the money that he invested. But when he invested the money, his marriage would last for a long time, long duration. He invests properly in the property. Over here, where he's married to a girl who could pull out of the marriage at any moment, there's a disincentive from investing. So therefore, Chazal said, if you invest in the property, we'll treat you like an aris. We'll treat you like a sharecropper. And whatever the minhag medina is for sharecroppers who invest in the property, that's how you'll be reimbursed or paid out. If the balabait pulled the plug on the aris, how would he get reimbursed? That's the same way he'll get reimbursed. Therefore, my time of abdu barabana takanta. Why did the rabbana do this in this case? Because otherwise he'd be disincentivized from investing in the property, and he would milk the property for everything. He'll end up doing whatever is the most expedient in terms of production and in terms of taking out, and he'll invest the least. That means after a short period of time, he could lay the land to waste, or it would be less productive. So instead, we incentivize him to invest in the property for the long term by giving him better rights or more rights in terms of reimbursement or collection if the woman walks out of the marriage or this young girl walks out of the marriage in the case of miyun. Hai tata. Tanafla arba me'azuze bechuzai. So this is a woman who got 400 zuz bechuzai. Azil gavra afik shit mea. So then this individual went ahead and expended 600. Aiti arba mea bade de ka'ati. Itzirchle chad zuza b'shaka minayu. So then he brought the 400 with him. And he needed one zuz out of that 400. Ata the kame de Rabbi Ami, they went before Rabbi Ami. Amalei, masha otzi otzi, masha achal achal. What he expended, he expended. What he ate, he ate. Meaning that he already expended 600, and now he had taken nothing from it except this one zuz that he needed, because whatever reason he needed that along the way. He says, well, that's exactly our Mishnah. You take one zuz, you got some benefit, so much otsi, whatever he expended is done. What he ate, what he took, he's duked. Amarle Rabbanan Rabbi Ami, Hani Mila Hechid Kachel Peret. That's when he's eating Perot. Hakarnaka Achel Voltai. What are you talking about? Over here, he did not take Perot. Money, we've seen that from the Mishnah. When the woman brings in money, you have to buy Karka with the money. And the Karka remains the Karen. And then he eats the Perot. Over here, when he took that one zuz from the 400, it was part of the Karen. It's as if he invested additional money in the property. It's not that he took benefit out of the property. It's rather, it's as if he put 601 into the property. In came, habilei hotzi v'lo achal. So if that's the case, then it should be deemed as a case where he expended but got no benefit. Ishbak hama hotzi v'ito. He'll take a shvuah to how much he expended, how much he invested, and he'll get reimbursed for it. So in this case, he'll get the 600 back. The one was hers anyway, so he doesn't need to reimburse that. And he should be reimbursed for his expenses in this case. Because when he utilized that money, clearly wasn't payrot that he was utilizing. He was almost borrowing money from the woman. He was using part of the Karen to invest in the property. And therefore, it's not deemed to be as if he benefited or got payrot out of the property. And therefore, he can be fully reimbursed for his expenditures. So he takes the shvuah, how much he expended, and then he'll be reimbursed. That's only if there's benefit that's equal to his expenditure. So now you can look at that in one of two ways. Meaning that you can look at that the chumrah or the kula. Is that a chumrah which says that he will only be reimbursed up to the amount of benefit that the field garnered from his investment? That doesn't mean it has to be right away, the investment. But if someone invested it, it would increase the value of the property by that amount. So is that a cap on how much hotza'ah, how much you'll be reimbursed? He'll get reimbursed no more than the shevach. Or does that say that he can get more reimbursement? That means that if the shevach exceeds the hotza'ah, they should pay him back even more, because that's the benefit that she garnered here from the property, the mayi hilchoto. So amar abayi, shemaya shevach yoter al hotza'ah. If the shevach exceeds hotza'ah, notelat hotza'ah below shvuah, that he will take the hotza'ot without a shvuah. Because at this point, the field is worth more than his expenditures. So why should he have to take a shvuah about his expenditures? It's clear that the value of the field is increased far more than he invested. So let him just tell us what his hotza'ot are. We'll pay him off. In a sense, he's losing because he invested and it went up and the value is greater now. So we're paying him hotza'ot instead of shevach. So of course he's losing. He should take it without a shvuah. He says, if you do that, then everybody's going to play a game, which is they'll figure out how much the value of the field has increased, and they'll say they invested one zuz less than that. Then they won't have to take a shvuah. They'll get reimbursed for the amount, and it'll be less than the shevach. You're setting up a scenario in which people are going to cheat in this scenario. So Rava says it to the tzad chumrah. Abaye looked at the tzad kula, which was, the kula was that he should be able to garner the hotza'ot without any shvuah, because the shevach exceeded the hotza'ot. Rava says you can't do that, because if someone has to take without a shvuah, then you lose your whole deterrence factor, which is you'll start making up how much he invested, because he knows his cap. As long as he's under the shevach, he'll get reimbursed. So Rava says it's the other way around. The shevach is a cap on the amount he'll be reimbursed. And he rereads the Mishnah to read like this to avoid the problem that you're saying. The Mishnah seems to say he gets his reimbursement, he gets his hotza'ot back. It says this, hotza'ah yoter l'shevach in lo elo hotza'ah shur shevach. The expenditures that are equal to the shevach. That's what he's entitled to, bishvuah, and he has to take it with a shvuah. Ibailo, baal shorid arisin tachtav mahu. If the baal brings in sharecroppers to work the field on his behalf, what happens now? They get divorced. And the woman says, you know what? You were his employees. It's my field now. You don't get anything. Let him pay you. Let him take care of you. Adaita de baal nachit. Since they went down based on the husband's directive, istalik le baal, istalik lehu. So if the baal is thrown out of the property because they got divorced, istalik lehu, they are also thrown out of the property. They have no rights here anymore. Odilma, adaita de ara nachit. The reason he brought in the sharecroppers is to work the land and take care of the land. Vara kikaimo, darisa kaimo. So it doesn't matter who the owner of the land is, the sharecropper is there to improve and work the land. Whoever the beneficiary of their work is, whether it's the husband or the woman, doesn't matter. They're there to take care of the land, to work the land, to take their percentage, and give the residual payment to the Baal, the owner, whether the owner is the husband or whether the owner is the wife. So Matkif lo rova bar avchanan, maishna, how is this any different? Mayorei the toks de chavero, the natash lo birshut. Something along the lines of what you're asking, which is, she didn't ask for them. She has a right to do whatever she wants with their property. So this is the equivalent of a case where someone goes into his friend's property and invests in his friend's property, improves, works, does everything for his friend's property. Doesn't know about it. Didn't ask him for it. Doesn't know about it. Shamin lo. Then we assess it. He gets the lesser of whether his expenditures or the benefit that he created. Nobody asked him to be in there. And therefore, if the friend says, what are you doing out of my field? He has to pay him the lesser of the expenditures or the shevach or the benefit that he created. So the person whose field that was invested in won't lose anything because he's either reimbursing for the increased value or he's reimbursing for the hotzaot when the value is greater than that. So he has nothing to lose. Why don't we say the same thing over here? The woman should pay as if this is a third party that walked into her field that she didn't ask for. And she'll pay the lesser of the hotzaot or the shevach. She shouldn't have to keep them on the land. She'll just give them the lesser of those two items and not lose anything. So hatam leki inish de torach. Hagayik baal de torach. Over there was nobody else working the field. Over there, the field was just laying fallow. Nobody was doing anything for it. So in a sense, when this guy jumped into the field, he benefited his neighbor. He did something that was, in a sense, altruistic because he invested in his field, improved his field, but nobody else was going to do anything, and the baal himself wasn't going to do anything. On the other hand, over here, had the baal, the husband, not brought these arisim out, he himself would have done the work over here. So now, if he himself would have done the work, and then they got divorced, he would have been bumped out. When they got divorced, he would have been lost everything, and he would have been bumped out of the field, and he would have gotten nothing. So they, as proxies for the baal, should be no better than that. Because the baal could have done it. Had he done it, then there would have been the same improvement to the land, and the woman would have been the same benefit without having these arisim in there. So in a sense, the arisim did no more than what would have happened to the land had the husband been doing it. So now where it says, "May havi Allah." So what's the din here? Rav Huna b'Rei Rav Yeshua, chazinan. We have to take a look. Ibal arisu. Then if the husband had the ability to take care of the land, if he himself could have worked the land and taken care of it, istalk le baal, istalk lehu. If the baal gets thrown out of the land because of the divorce, then so too these arisim get thrown out of the land, and she can make the claim that before, which is that the husband could have done this, and I would have the same benefit, and I wouldn't have to pay him. So you did for me nothing more than the husband would have done. Ibal lav arisu. On the other hand, if the husband couldn't have done it on his own, aro le arisa kaimi. Then the land stays with the arisim, because now they become no worse than someone who goes down to his friend's property when he's not there. But over here, they're in a relationship of an aris, and therefore the relationship remains because the woman is the beneficiary of their work. Because her husband would have done this. And the fact that they are there already indicates that they're doing something to benefit the woman, not just to benefit the baal, they're benefiting whoever is the owner of this land. Now, in general, there's a Gemara in Baba Metzia which says that if you hire workers to go work the field, and then instead of showing them your field, you show them your friend's field, and they go work in your friend's field. And then when you're finished, they say, you know, sorry, that was my friend's field, he's got to pay you. Over there, the person who hired them has got to pay. Because he misled them, he put them into the field, he was there, he's got to reimburse them. Now, can he make a claim against his friend? Maybe, depending on the circumstances. But he'll have to pay the po'alim. So why don't we say the same thing over here? Why isn't the baal on the hook for the arisim? Sure, the woman may not have to pay them. But the baal should have to pay them because he hired them and he put them in someone else's property, meaning his wife's property. That's what it says over here. It's different because he told the arisim that they're working in nichsei malog. He disclosed the information up front. So since he disclosed to them that they're working in his wife's nichsei malog, they understand the risk that they might get kicked off if there's a divorce. In the case of Baba Metzia, then he didn't inform them that they're going to someone else's field. In that case, he's on the hook for the reimbursement. Yeah. Had he not told them, then he would have the reimbursement like the case in Baba Metzia, because he misled them into a situation where they didn't know the risks that they were undertaking. Yibaylo, bal shemachar karka leperot, mahu. The husband sells his rights, his leasehold in the property. The woman owns the karen. She owns the property itself. He's entitled to take the perot, the output of the field, the leasehold in the field. So we've discussed until now in the Mishnayot that what the woman's right is in terms of selling the keren, the underlying field. How does that work? So in terms of while they're married, seemingly she has no rights to sell the field to the other party, and the party take the field at that time unless the husband agrees, and the husband could take the property back. She could sell it for post her husband's death. I mean, if their husband predeceases her, then she will own the property. She could sell that option to someone that she can't sell. But as long as she's married, she can't sell the keren. What about in the other direction? Can the husband sell the peirot? Can he sell his rights in the leasehold? Mi amrina and my dekani akne. Whatever he owns, he can sell. Meaning, whatever rights you own, you can sell those rights. Odilma ketino le rabbanim peirot, the baal. Why did the peirot belong to the baal? Mishum ravach beta. Because that expands the household. He's going to take that money and reinvest it or utilize it for the benefit of the household. So over here, when he sells it out, and it's not to the benefit of the household, maybe not. Aval lizvune lo, but to sell it, no lo. Yehuda mar bar mirei mar, mishmei durova mar, mashasa sui. What he did, he did. If he sold it, he can sell that leasehold, and it's done. Rapapa amar mishmei durova. So we have an alternative view in the name of Rova. There's alternative girsa, which is it's Rapapian. But either way, we have a machlokin in what Rova said. Lo asab lo klom. He did absolutely nothing. He doesn't have the right to sell it because Ravach Beita, it's supposed to be for the benefit of the household, and therefore he doesn't have a right to sell the leasehold in this manner. Amar Papa, Hadi Yehuda Mar Bar Mereimar, that's what he said in the name of Rava, La Befeirush Itmar. He never heard that explicitly from Rava, Ela Michlola Itmar. He inferred it from a case that came before Rava, and as he's going to show now, he inferred incorrectly. His inference was wrong. This woman came into a marriage, and as part of her nixei malog, she brought in two maidservants, two shvachot. This man went ahead and married a second wife. And he says, you know what, you'll take one of the maidservants. One of them will take care of the woman who brought them in, and one of them will deal with the new wife. She came before Rava, tzavcha. She started to scream. He didn't pay heed to her, meaning that you have no claim over here. What you're saying is true, but it still doesn't give you a right of claim. You can't force your husband not to do that. Manda chaza, now he's referring to Yehuda Mar Bar Mereimar, the one who saw Savar, Bishum the Savar Masha Asasui. That the reason that he did that was because whatever is done is done. Whatever the husband did, he did, and you can't unwind it. It's his right in the leasehold. He's allowed to use the output or the utility of this shifcha. And so he gave that to his other wife to use, and that's his right to do it. As if he sold it to someone else, it's his right to utilize it. He shouldn't have done it, but once he's done it, it's done. That's what those that witnessed this thought, including Yehuda Mar Bar Mereimar, and that's why he's quoting the name of Rova, Velohi, and he got it wrong. Mishom Ravach Beita, because the real reason is, why can't the husband sell it? Is because of Ravach Beita, V'haka Ravach. And over here, this is Ravach Beita. Over here, when he gives the shifcha to the other wife, it remains in the totality of the household. This woman is part of the same household as the woman who brought in the shifchot. And therefore, when you have this shifcha that takes care of one woman, the other shifcha takes the other woman, in a sense, it's for the greater good of the household, and therefore, it's still classified as Ravach Beita. And that's why Rava said that she had no claim over here. V'hilchata, the locha is Baal Shemachar Karka, the peirot, lo asav lo klum. Obviously, based on that, then the only real way to read Rava is that it's a din in Ravach Beita, and you're not allowed to sell out your leasehold in the property. My daima, what's the reason? The reason that we don't do that is because we're afraid that it will diminish the value. Rava Amar Mishum Ravach Beita. Rava, on the other hand, says it's because we want it for the greater benefit of the household. So as Rava's Vashitato, like we saw before, quoted the name of Rapapa, Rapapi, that Rava believes that you can't sell it because of Ravach Beita. You have to keep it within the household. So if you keep it within the household, that's fine. So the case with the Shifcha, that was fine. Abaye says we're afraid of a different issue, which is we're afraid of the field going to waste or being utilized in an improper manner. Because the person who buys the leasehold from the Baal has no idea when he's going to lose that leasehold. As soon as the husband dies, he's going to lose the leasehold in the property. So therefore, what he tries to do is maximize his output during the time period that he has it with the risk. The husband might die and he'll lose everything here. So therefore he's disincentivized from investing and he's going to reap as much as he can from the land with putting in as little as possible. and therefore he will ruin the land, and we don't want that. That's why we don't allow him to sell it to a third party. The other hand, when the husband has it, he's not disincentivized from investing because he has another point at the end, which is that if his wife predeceases him, he will inherit the property. So he has a possibility that the property might end up being his and not his wife's property. If that's the case, then he will invest in it because, number one, he'll get better output over the long run. And even in the risk, he might lose the property if he dies. He still might benefit if his wife predeceases him and he'll get the property. So my binayu, what's the nafka meaning between them? He can binayu ara demikra of the mato, in a case where the land is very close to the city, and you keep an eye on the person that he sold the property to. In that case, according to Abaye, there's no issue because you'll know if he's not investing in the property, you can make demands on him to take care of the property. When it's far out in the fields and you can't watch him, you won't know that he's not investing or he's not treating the property properly. Inami balarisu. Or in the case where the husband is in aris, where he gives the lokeach perot mezumanim. He didn't sell him the rights to the perot in the land and he works the land himself, but rather he sold him the production of the land after the production comes out. So the husband will work the land, take care of it, and then he sells forward a portion of the fruits or the produce of that land. So the husband is actually acting like an aris now. He's actually the one working the land. He'll keep a certain percentage, and he'll grant a certain percentage to the buyer of the rights here. But in that case, you're not going to have a disincentive from investing because it's the husband who's still working the land. Inami zuzei v'kavid b'huiska. On the other hand, on Rava's side is, if he sells it and then with that money, he opens up a business or he invests the money where there's value to it, then it's Ravach Beita. So even though it was monetized and he's getting money, but he reinvested the money to the point where it's now Ravach Beita. In that case, Rava would agree that he could sell it because he's benefiting the household.
We would know if the method was Kayah, only if we knew afterwards.
I mean, is it enough that he intends to invest it or he invested it? Or does he have to actually show profits in order for it to be Ravach Beita, and then only retroactively will you know that the sale is a good sale? It's a bad investment, do you then say that the sale didn't go through because he didn't make it into Ravach Beita? Or is it enough that that's the intent to be considered the Ravach Beita? Okay, next Mishnah is a Mishnah that comes from Yevamot, and it also is a Mishnah that's discussed in Baba Batra as well. The Mishnah itself is difficult in Yevamot, it's difficult in Baba Batra, and it's difficult here as well, which is Shomeret Yevam, Shenaflula Nechasim, a woman who is waiting for Yibum. She's a Shomer Yevam, her husband passed away, and the brother has yet to perform Yibum with her. If she gets property during that period of time, Bodim Beit Shemai Beit Hillel, Shemocheret Benotenet Bekayam. She can exercise her right to transact in that property, Lechatchila, and there's no reversing the transaction. She has rights to transact. Even though we just saw previously in the Mishnayot that an Arusa is not allowed to do that, at least according to Beit Hillel, he can only do that b'diavad, but the chatchila, she shouldn't transact. What's the difference between an arusa and a shomer yavam? So that we saw in the Tosafot earlier, that when it comes to a shomer yavam, she is less connected than an arusa, or let's call it less of a safek married than an arusa. So that's what we saw in Tosafot before, which is that in the case of an arusa, most irusin will lead to nisuin. And therefore we deem it as if it's a real safek between the husband and the wife in terms of the property, and that's why we don't grant her real rights to transact in it, according to Beit Hillel. Over here, like you're suggesting, and that's what Tosafot said earlier, that by the Shomeret Yavam, it's an equally plausible that he'll perform Yibum or Chalitza. And since it's equally plausible, then she really has rights. And over here we say that she's a Vaday owner of the property, he's a Safek owner. And Safek ain't motzimidei Vaday, and therefore she can transact without any veto rights by the husband. Meita, if she passes away while she is a Shomeret Yavam. So now she's in this quasi-state. She's quasi-married to the brother who's supposed to bore Mibo, but she's also quasi-a free woman. She could just as easily be ended up with Chalitza and be independent. So now she died in this in-limbo state. What happens? Mayasu b'ktubata ubenichasim anichnasim v'yotzimima. What do we do with her ktuba, as well as the property that goes in and out with her? So this will have impact later on. The way Rashi defines ktubata over here is b'nidunya shechnisalo, the dowry that she brought in, b'shamatan lo b'ktuba, and they assess them in the ktuba, which is basically nichsa, tzon, or barzel. So that's what we have to discuss here, is that there are different pieces of the ktuba. When the woman brings in property to the marriage, there is the dowry that she brings in. Part of it could be nichsei tzon barzel, By Nichsei Tzon and Barzel, we assess the value of the property she brings in. Then the husband can do whatever he wants with the property. He can sell it. He can do as he pleases with the property. But then again, the end of the marriage, whether it's a case where she's an almanah, she's collecting her tuba, or a grushan collecting her tuba, she has rights to get back the assessed value. He has to repay the assessed value when she brought it in. Those are called Nichsei Tzon and Barzel. So there he has achrayut, responsibility for reimbursement of the property that she brings in. But in the interim, he can do as he pleases with the property. The other option is Nichsei Malog. Nichsei Malog are not assessed in value. Over there, the keren remains for the woman. The woman always owns the land. And when she leaves, she'll get the land back as part of her ketubah. The husband does not have rights to do whatever he wants with the property. He only gets payroll. He only gets the output of the leasehold on the property. Over there, he has no achrayut for the property. He has no responsibility for the property itself because he doesn't have to reimburse the full amount of the property. He just hands whatever it is back, and that's what the woman gets back. That was the last Mishnah. His improvement is the benefit of the output of the property. So whatever he invested, the value that he will garner is the better output of the property. If there was no output, he gets the money back, or the possibility that if his wife predeceases him, he actually will inherit the land. So by the husband, there's a lot of incentive to invest, even though technically the land could go back to the woman and he'll get nothing out of the land. So over here we have Nichsei Tzon of Barzel and Nichsei Malog. So that's what Maya Subik Tubata Ravashi calls Nichsei Tzon of Barzel. Umnechasim Shnechnasim Yotzimar are Nichsei Malog. Beit Shemai Omrim, Yuchalko, they divide them. Yoshea Baal and Yoshea Av. They divide them up between the Baal and the Av. Over here, Yoshea Av are the inheritors of the woman, which are either her father or her brothers. Yoshea Baal are the brothers of the Baal. Some want to suggest it's the Yabam, the one who would have been the Ibam. He's the inheritor over here. The most agree that Yoshea Baal means all the brothers of the Baal. They split it according to Beit Shammai. And as Rashi notes over here, when Beit Shammai says that they split it, we're not talking about the Tuba of the Baal, that clearly goes to the Yoshea Baal, and the Yoshea Av have no rights in that Tuba. Ubeit Halel Omrim, and this is where it gets difficult. Beit Hillel says, Nechasim b'chezkatam. The Nechasim are b'chezkatam. You could write there, colon. Nechasim go to where the chazaka is, colon. What does that mean? Uktuba b'chezkat Yoshea Baal. And therefore, the ktuba is in the chezkat Yoshea Baal. The ktuba is the 200 zuz of the ktuba plus the tosevik ktuba that the husband put in. Because the husband is the one responsible for paying the ktuba. The money now sits with the husband. And since the money sits with the husband and he has yet to expend it, he is responsible for it. But the chazaka is with the husband. The one who wants to take money out now would be the wife, and that would be motzi mechavero lavaraya. And in this case, therefore, the chazaka will remain with the Yoshea Baal. Nichasim and nichnasim yotzim ima, property that goes in and out with her, bechezkat Yosheav. That property which is nichsei malog, which always remain in her possession, which is whether she was a shomeret yavam, or whether she was already married and the Ibum was performed, they're still Nichsei Malog and they always remain her property. Therefore, the Yoshea Av get them. What about Nichsei Tzon or Barzel? So that is a question. What do you do with Nichsei Tzon or Barzel? Rashi says, Ubenichsei Tzon or Barzel b'chezkatan, b'baba bacha, perk mishemeit, mefaresh b'chezkat mehim mukhzakim. Im b'chezkat Yoshea Baal, ho b'achriyatim alav, o b'chezkat Yoshea Isha, shayu shela. Are they in the hands of the Baal, the Yoshea Baal, because he's responsible to replace the property by Nechsei Tzon Barzel? They assess the value and he'll have to replace it. Or are they Chezkat Yoshea Isha because they were her property? It's her property and therefore she should get it. So the way Rashi reads the Mishnah, he reads, Beit Hillel Omrim, Nechasim B'Chezkatan, the Nechasim are in their Chazakah. That's referring to Nechsei Tzon Barzel. They're b'chazaka. Which is their chazaka? We don't know. Machlok adam moraim in Baba Batra, whether it belongs to the Yoshea Av or Yoshea Baal. Then ktuba is the core ktuba, the tosefik ktuba that the husband brought into the marriage. B'chazkat Yoshea Baal, that belongs to the Yoshim of the husband. Nichasim anichnasim yotzimima, nichseim malog, b'chazkat Yoshea Av, that belongs to the wife's property. So that's the way Rashi reads this. Tosfot, on the other hand, says, Vein nira l'Rabbeinu Tam. That's not the way that Rabbeinu Tam reads it. Elahacha modi kuli ama. Shehem b'chezkat Yoshei HaBaal. That they are in the chezkat of the Yoshei HaBaal. Te'avam kvar hayam muchzak b'nechasim kodem mitata. Because the Avam already had rights in there prior to her death. Bishat mitat achiv. Shu yoresh. Because of the death of his brother, who he would inherit. Dein lalikach tubak lal ad shetachlot. She doesn't have a right to her ketubah until they have chalitza. So therefore, in that scenario, the nechsei tzon and barzel would go to the yorshim of the husband. Where do we have the safek or question? That's in a case where nafala bayit alav al ishto. They were together in a house, and then a house collapsed on them. In that scenario, the yorshei av and the yorshei abal have equal rights. Because we don't know who passed away first. In that instance, they have equal rights to the nechsei tzon and barzel because of that safek. On the other hand, here, where the Yavam is still alive, and he would have been in line to inherit his brother, then nechasim b'chezkatan means that they go to the Yorshei HaBaal, or basically to the Yavam. So Rashi reads nechasim b'chezkatan, just means that the Tzon and Barzel and their chazakah. What does that mean? Machloket Amoraim. Then Tosfot says nechasim b'chezkatan means that the Tzon and Barzel goes to where they are now. That means it stays within the husband's family. That's it. And then we move on to Tubah and Nechsei Melog. There are still others who suggest that Nechasim b'chezkatan, that's a general statement with a colon, all Nechasim go as b'chezkatan. What does that mean? Tubah b'chezkat Yorshei HaBaal. The Ketubah, which includes the Ketubah, 200 zuz. The Tosefet HaKetubah and the Nechsei Tzon HaBarzel, because they're written into the Ketubah. So all of those items are in this category, b'chezkatan of Yorshei HaBaal. They go to Yorshei HaBaal. So that's the same reading as Tosafot, but not reading it within the words of Nechasim b'chezkatan, but reading it as Nechasim b'chezkatan colon, Ketubah includes not only Ketubah and Tosefet Ketubah, but also includes Nechsei Tzon u'Barzel. Right, so now, Heniach Achiv Ma'ot, if his brother left over monies that he will inherit when he marries the woman, Yilakach ben Karka v'uchel Peirot. Then those are the equivalent of Nechsei Melog that she's bringing into the marriage, and therefore she buys property with it, and he eats the peirot. Because his brother's property is responsible for the payment of her ketubah. So whatever he inherits from his brother, her ketubah has a lien on the brother's property. And what we're suggesting over here is those monies are also deemed to be responsible for the payment of the ketubah. Metaltele, he thinks, or Meshabde the ketubah. And since Metalti Mershad Ketubah, he has to do something responsible with them so that she still has a lien on that property. Perot HaTlushim, perot that already picked, in a karka, Yilakach Behem Karka, V'chol Perot. Similarly, he has to buy karka with them, and then he gets the benefit of the perot, because again, they are Meshubad to her Ketubah. HaMechubarim BeKarka. If you have perot that are attached to the ground, Amar Rabbi Meir, Shemin Otan Kamehin Yafin BePerot, V'Kamehin Yafin BeLo Perot. We assess how much they are worth with the payroll on them and without the payroll. V'motar ilakach behen karka. And the remainder he purchases parka. V'hu ochel payroll. And he eats the payroll. Because those properties were considered to be a part of the brother's estate. And the ketubah has a lien on that estate. So therefore he has to take that value of the payroll to mechubarim, which is still considered to be like the karka, and assess that value and place it in escrow, in a sense, to buy property with it so that the wife has a lien on that property for ketubah. Chamim amrim, perot ha-mechubarim b'karka shelo. That perot that are attached to the ground belong to him. They're no different than the karka itself, which he will eat the perot. Hatlushim in a karka, anything that is separated from the karka, kodokodem zachabahen. Whoever gets there first, gets them. Kadam hu, if he takes them first, zacha, then he gets it. Kadmahi, if she gets there first, yilakach ben karka v'uchol peirot. Then you purchase land with it, and he can eat the peirot. So in that case, the chachamim over here disagree with Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir believes that the metaltalin are meshubad to the ketubah. Just like the karka itself is meshubad the karka, so too are the metaltalin. And therefore, anytime there is metaltalin in the estate, you have to make them into karka. Because they're meshubad to her, they are encumbered to her ketubah. And the only way to preserve that encumbrance is to make them into land. So therefore, any metalkun that he finds, whether it's perot tushim, ksafim, any of these items, he will have to then sell them and take that money and buy karka for her to have that encumbrance for her ketubah. The other hand, the chachamim believe that metalkun are not mishubadim to the ketubah. And then therefore, kolakodim zachabahen. Whoever gets there first gets them. That's true by perot tushim, that's true by ksafim. Whoever takes possession of them gets them. If he takes possession first, then she has no rights to them. If she takes possession first, then they become like Nichsei Malog. And when she brings him into the marriage, then he buys karka with them, and he's the beneficiary of the peirot, but he has to buy karka with them because they're hers that she's bringing in. But that doesn't mean that if neither of them took possession, the default situation is not that she gets the mitalkalim because they're encumbered to her ktubah. They disagree with Rabbi Meir on this point. All right, so then the Mishnah continues and says, Kansa, areiki yishto l'chol davar. Once he marries her, the Yavam, she becomes his wife in all ways. Bilvad should take tubatal nechsei bala rishon. The only difference between a normal wife and this woman is that her lien is not on the Yavam's property, but rather on the original husband's property. The reason Hishto l'chol davar has significance, we've already seen it in Yavamot, is that if he then divorces her and remarries her, it's mutar. The Isser of Eshet Ach disappears completely to the point where she's deemed to be a full-fledged wife to him. And therefore, if he divorces her, he can remarry her, and the Isser of Eshet Ach does not come back. That's what it means, Ishto l'chol davar. Literally, she is like a wife to him at this point. Now, lo yomar la, he doesn't have a right to say to her, Harei ktubatich, munechet al ha-shulchan, your ktubah is over there, and that's where you have your payment for your ktubah. Elokol nechasav achrayin lektubata. The entire estate of the deceased brother is encumbered to the ktubah. And that's because of the takana of Shimon ben Shetach, who established that the problem with having the money be designated or escrowed for the ktubah was, it was very easy then for the husband to throw her out because the money was gone already. In this way, where you encumber the whole properties, then the woman has a lien against everything and she can pull the money back if he sells the property out. But on the other hand, the husband is actually going to lose something when he divorces her. Therefore, it's a disincentive to get divorced. And just like this is true by a Yevama, it's also true by a regular wife. And therefore, he cannot just designate a particular piece of property or money for the payment of ktubah. She has a lien on his entire estate for the same reason that we said before that Shimon and Shetach established in terms of ktubah. Girsha, he divorces her, in la'ala ktubata. At that point, she only has her ktubah, meaning that the lien is forgiven or removed because he paid her out on the ktubah. Once he pays her out on the ktubah, her lien is gone. But until that point in time, she has a lien on the entire estate or anything that he owns. Hechzira, if he remarries her, harihi chol anashim, she is like any other woman, vein la'ala ktubah bilvad. And therefore, zira manat ktubah rishona, he brings her back, it's like as if she's getting her original tuba, meaning by Yivama. If he marries her and does Yibum with her, he inherits his brother's estate, plus he's married to the woman. When he divorces her, she gets her tuba and she's out. In the sense that if he doesn't remarry her, he's allowed to keep the estate or whatever he inherited from his brother. Once he performs Yibum, all that property is his. So if he divorces her and gives her tuba, he keeps the rest of the brother's estate. If he remarries her, then she becomes like any other woman, and she's connected to the original ktubah. When a person remarries the woman, it's as if it's premised on the original ktubah. In a case where this woman is waiting to have yibum performed with her, and she dies. Mikovra, who buries her? Yoshea Baal, Kavrila, the inheritors of the husband bury her, the kayarte ktubah, because they are the inheritors of her ktubah. Or Dilma Yoshea Av Karbila, or maybe the Yoshim of the woman bury her, Tekayarte Nechasim Nechasim Yotzimima, because they're going to get the Nechsei Malog. And as Tosfo points out over here, this question is even more pronounced for Rashi. Because if you believe that the Nechsei Tzonim Barzel and the Mishnah are not subsumed under the term Ktuvah, and therefore the outcome of Nechsei Tzonim Barzel based on the Machlokan and Baba Batra, will be actually to split it between Yoshea Baal and Yoshea Av, then we have an issue now, which is Nidunya. The Kvura was, the husband is responsible for the Kvura of his wife, Tachat Nidunyata, in exchange for the dowry that he gets. In this instance, according to Rashi, he's not getting the dowry. And therefore, the Yoshea Av, or the beneficiaries of the Nechsei Milog, plus, they have a portion of the Nechsei Tzonim Barzel. And so therefore the question is, what is the Baal's responsibility in Kvura here? According to Tosafot, that the Nechsei Tzonim Barzel goes to the Baal, and the Nechsei Malog go to the Yoshea Av, In that case, that's exactly the question. You have half of the nedunya, half of the dowry going to the Yorshei HaBaal, half of the dowry going to the Yorshei HaAv. And therefore, who is responsible for the burial over here? Tachat nedunya ta. According to Rashi, the majority of the nedunya is going to the Yorshei HaAv. So then the question is, why should the Baal be responsible at all? So you could argue it's the equivalent of a woman who comes to a marriage without a nedunya whatsoever. And in that case, the husband is still responsible for the burial. Or the question can be posed in this way, how similar is she to an arusa? In the case of an arusa, the husband is not responsible for the burial of the woman because he doesn't get her nedunya. So maybe the same is true here by a shomer yavam. Or on the other hand, do we say since he's the beneficiary of the property that is coming from his brother, if he takes her as a wife, then we now, while she's a shomer yavam, demand from him to bury her because he will be the beneficiary.
And Tosafot even suggests that maybe her ketubah is deemed to be her nedunya over here. That is because when her husband died, technically she was entitled to her ketubah. Now she re-enters that ketubah into the new marriage, encumbers it to her original husband's property, and it's as if she's handing her ketubah to the new husband, and that will become or be deemed to be her nedunya. And that's how you have to explain it according to Rashi, to say that the Yorshei HaBaal have some form of nedunya over here, so that they would be obligated in the krura.
So Amrav Amram, Tashma, Netanya, we have a braita, Shomeret Yavam Shemeta, Yorsheha Yorshei Ketubata Chayavim Bekvurata. Those that will inherit her ketubah are the ones that are deemed responsible for her kvura. So if that is the case, then it means that the Yorshei HaBaal are the ones that are responsible for her kvura. The ketubah is in lieu of the burial, and since they're going to be Yoresh the ketubah, they got to take care of her kvura. And Rabbi Amaf and Amid Tanina, we also have a Mishnah that supports this. Amana Nizonet Minichse Yitomim, and Amana draws sustenance from the estate, Masei Yadeh Shelahen, and her output belongs to them. She's collecting Mizonot, so therefore her Masei Yadayim belong to them. Vein Chayavim Bik Burata. They're not responsible for her burial. Yosheha, Yoshei Ketubah, Ta. Those that are going to inherit her Ketubah, Chayavim Bik Burata. They are responsible for her Kvura. Alright, so they could be the same people if he only had one wife. Then they'd be the same people. On the other hand, if he has multiple wives, then we have Ketubat Benin Dechrin, and then her children will get precedence in her Ketubah. So in that case, it's her children that are responsible for it, not all the children of this husband, not the estate as a whole. Bezi Amana Sheish La Shnei Yorshin. Where is there a woman who has two inheritors? Aviyamer Zu Shomeret Yavam. That is a Shomeret Yavam where she has different Yorshim. So even though the pshat of this Mishnah would have been speaking about a case, again, maybe talking about Ketubat B'tinichrin, her children themselves. Nevertheless, because of the Yitur HaLashon, that's what Tosfot says over here, he is Midayek, Abaye, of the Mishnah, that it means, what type of Yosheha, Yoshei Ketubata? It's a person who has two different sets of inheritors, because the properties are going to get subdivided between the Yosheha Baal and the Yosheha Av. And in that instance, the Yosheha, Yoshei Ketubata will be responsible for the Kvura, and that corroborates what we just said over here in the Braita, that the Yoshei Ketubata are the ones responsible for her Kvura. All right, we'll stop here, 6 lines down on the top of Pe Aleph, Amud Aleph.